Great. Anybody here want to testify on redistricting?
I'm excited.
Besides Senator Miller. Couple of, Annette, huh? Get rolling here.
We're missing some.
Couple of pieces of paper for the record. Letter from Greg Smith, once again asking for a field hearing out east, and we're answering him back saying, we're going to do something, we're not sure what. But we need to focus in on the growth areas is what our reply has been. Letter from Shady Cove, Crook County. And the official numbers for the record, the official census numbers that we got about a week and a half ago.
Again?
So.
There's no change.
No change, yeah, this is just for the record, John. In there. All right, let's close that public testimony, public hearing, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 834, the Chad hearing.
Chad?
Chad hearing. Scott?
The man right there.
You're the man. What time's the 3 o'clock hearing? Beats me.
Leading to election.
Should I wait?
Wait. You wait. You're liable to get left behind, buddy.
Okay. I was wondering whether I was being tape recorded yet or not. Okay. Chair Harper, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Tye. I'm the operations manager for the Elections Division, Secretary of State's office. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today about the need to improve our standards for determining a voter's intent when inspecting ballots. Senate Bill 834 adds a provision to the current conduct of elections law to require the Secretary of State to adopt rules establishing uniform standards to be used by county clerks and other elections officials in determining an elector's choice for an office or a measure. Following last year's general election, Secretary of State and the Association of County Clerks formed an elections task force to review the conduct of the nation's first vote-by-mail general election and make recommendations for improvements. The task force conclusions are in support of this measure to establish uniform standards to be used by county elections officials to determine and record an elector's choice for an office or measure. Specifically, the task force recommended the vote-by-mail and recount directive should include more guidance on ballot counting standards, including specific instructions for various optical scan and punch card systems at use in Oregon. Second, the task force recommended, regardless of the vote tally equipment being used, procedures for processing of ballots must continue to be reviewed on an ongoing basis, and those procedures must be detailed in writing. Third, more detailed and uniform standards also need to be adopted for, one, election observers, two, pre-inspection and recount of ballots to determine the voter's intent, and three, transport and security of ballots. The Secretary of State's office will soon initiate meetings with county elections officials in order to develop and adopt uniform standards by rule for determining voters' intent in time for application of the May 2002 primary election. By using the administrative rule adoption procedures, the public will be ensured full opportunity to provide input on the proposed standards. We support Senate Bill 834. Thank you, and I can answer any questions,
Mr. Chairman.
I hope.
In a minute.
Why can't you already do this?
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, we do refer to, voter intent has been part of the Oregon statute for as long as I've been involved with the Secretary of State's office, and then from my understanding, it's always been a voter intent state and statute. So the process of determining voters' intent has always been part of the county clerk's instructions and guidance that they provide to the election board workers. And the system that's in place currently is that a panel of four citizens that are hired on as election board workers determine a voter's intent if if the vote is in question.
But, Chairman, again, you have general rulemaking authority in the Secretary of State's office.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, yes, that's true.
That's a law now that refers to, you know, the elector's choice, so on and so forth. Why can't you just go ahead and do this?
Okay.
Why do you need a law?
Well, we...
Why do you need a law?
They have to explore that. Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, the determining of a voter's intent has always been a part of the election board manual, which was adopted by administrative rule and used in the polling place election. With the passage of going to all vote by mail by initiative, we met with the clerks and we developed this directive, which is our Oregon's vote by mail procedures, where basically we do address how to determine voter's intent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think there's a misunderstanding here of
who... Leave it in, Fred.
This is Fred Neal of the Oregon Elections Division. Okay. This is not our bill. It's the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and we don't know who the sponsor of it is on that committee.
Neither do I.
Oh.
Speaking of the chair.
Withdraw all of my Senator Minnis is correct that we do have the statutory authority to adopt these rules, and we are in fact proceeding with the adoption of these and have a schedule for doing so. But this bill doesn't prevent us from going ahead. It just adds your seal of approval to our efforts, and therefore we support it.
Chair Harper, can I withdraw all my answers?
Well, the chair of this committee knows that we had a fairly liberal policy for introducing legislation from the Senate.
From the Senate Judiciary
Committee.
Judiciary, yes. Yeah, make sure we understand that. Yeah.
Well, so what we...
Okay, so much for this bill.
All right. Close public hearing on that thing. Am I going to trust you guys to do this right?
Chair Harper, you bet. You can trust us.
Probably figure out whose bill this was, too.
I want to know why we tore it up in public.
Probably the House Majority Leaders.
I'll hear about that.
The chair made me do it. Let's open a public hearing on 2583 if we dare. The inactive voter issue. We have a House bill that came across. Charles, you're signed up. And then we have Senator Miller is quite interested in this whole subject. So what I want to do today is let's get all these issues on the table, come up with a bill, a concept that we can all support and get moving with it. So, or we just may tear it up if you have a lousy briefing here.
If we know how you do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. And my comments are really focused at both bills, mm-hmm. and dealing with the topic of maintaining voter registration files. And so I hope Senator Miller will accept these views also in conjunction with his bill, as with in conjunction with the bill that was introduced at the request of the Secretary of State and the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Because both bills address the issue of maintenance of the voter registration file. I'd like first to kind of draw a framework of how this works. And it was all based, we made a bunch of changes back a few years ago, based on a federal act, which is commonly referred to as NAVRA, the National Voter Registration Act. It was enacted in 1993. Part of that, I would like to walk us through some definitions. An active registrant means someone who is registered and fully qualified. I don't think anybody has any questions about that. An inactive registrant means someone who is registered but not fully qualified. A canceled registrant means flagged for removal from the file or removed from the file. And a purged registrant means removed from the file. I've got a couple other definitions in here called acknowledgement notice and verification or confirmation notice. Now, these things come from the National Voter Registration Act, and they've been somewhat brought into Oregon statutes. Now, this act requires states to conduct a general program that makes reasonable effort to remove the names of ineligible voters from the official list of eligible voters. The National Act prohibits the removal of voters from the voter registration list for failure to vote or a change of address with a location within the county clerk's jurisdiction, even if they fail to notify us of that change of address. The National Act allows for the removal of individuals from the voter registration files for, at the request of the registrant.
Excuse me, Charles.
Yes.
Removal means purged. It doesn't mean inactive.
No.
Okay.
Removal is... And as we get a little farther into it, I think you'll see where this act talks about inactive and how we have to track inactive voters for a period of time before we can cancel, purge, remove them from the list. Okay, we have six reasons why we can remove. One, their request. Two, mental incapacity as provided by state law. And in Oregon, you have to be judged mentally incompetent in order for us to remove you from the registration file. Not just that a relative writes in and says Aunt Millie is no longer able to vote. That doesn't do it. Criminal convictions is provided by state laws.
So that note I got about Senator Miller voting, it wouldn't be there.
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer not to comment on that. The criminal convictions is provided by state law. In Oregon, if you're in the custody of the Oregon Corrections Division, you lose your right to vote. Or in the federal facility at Sheridan.
Senator Brown.
And just to clarify that point, because some equal protection arguments were made either in, I think, in some of our earlier hearings, so that once you're no longer in custody or no longer in parole or on probation, you as an Oregonian that have served your sentence on your conviction are entitled to vote.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
And I would also say that if you're no longer in the custody, and this is one of the very difficult things in administering this part of the law, is they have so many different programs, work programs, various other programs. The question of custody, are they in the custody or not in the custody? We have the programs where you have them in the county jails in some cases. And this creates a real difficulty from an administration standpoint, knowing what are the status of these persons. But the law is clear. They lose the right to vote, not the right to be registered. They still have that. But they only lose the right to cast a ballot while in the custody of the Oregon Corrections Division. Okay. Fourth reason, on the death of the registrant.
That seems a little harsh.
Yes. But it works that way. Fifth reason.
You know, it's the law.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not Chicago.
Not Chicago.
The fifth reason is written confirmation of a change of address of the registrant outside the jurisdiction. We receive information from in Yamhill County, from Marion County, that that voter is now registered there. We have a right to cancel them, remove them, purge them from the file. Okay. Sixth. And this is the one I want to focus on as we get in this discussion. Upon failure to respond to a confirmation notice and not voting in two general elections after the date of the notice. Now, that's all from the federal statute in which we brought into Oregon law several years ago. Yes?
Current law reads this way.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair.
What else do we need?
Okay. Well, when we adopted a House bill in the last session to deal with, again, responding to this requirement of having an ongoing process for identifying ineligible voters, last session there was introduced a bill that would inactivate a voter or basically send them a confirmation notice, put them in active status if you haven't voted in 5 years. What we missed in that was the issue of what if a person hasn't voted? He responds to that that notice, and if you notice on second page at the top, that we have to track these inactive status through the second general. If at any time during that tracking period the resident attempts to vote, submits a change of address, or re-registers in the same jurisdiction, we move them to active status, which then, if they choose not to vote, triggers another notice because they didn't vote, but they responded, they're back active. And so by adding the words to it, that's what this bill does, is adds the words nor updated. See, has neither voted nor updated. It gets us out of that cycle where if somebody chose never to vote but still responds, no, I'm still here, I want to be registered, but chooses not to vote, we don't keep sending them notices, making them inactive. They respond to the notice, we make them active, and that's it. That's the reason for this bill, in a nutshell. The policy continues of confirming that you're there, and after the extended period of time, and the federal statute talks about doing this if you haven't voted in an extended period of time, and the last legislature determined that to be 5 years. That's what. Be happy to answer any questions. Okay. That's kind of the focus of the bill.
Thank you, Charles. I want you to tell us what's on your mind also before we get done. I mean, what you're looking for about, you know, the whole, what you're after in your bill, or how that rolls into this one sooner or later. We can do it now if you like.
That'd be fine, because I think it's a pretty close match. I'd be glad to have you stay there.
Okay.
The National Voter Registration Act, where it says down near the bottom of page one, allows for removal. It's what I'm trying to get at in my bill is an emphasis on retention as opposed to removal, such that, and I don't know where in the statute, well, I guess it is in the statute, and I'm not sure I remember the history of determining that after 5 years you would be required to take it upon yourself to try to get people off the rolls. Because as I read this federal act, it just says, upon failure to respond to a confirmation notice, and unless the federal statute tells you when to send that confirmation notice, it's something we added.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, you're absolutely correct. If I may read from the Federal Elections Commission Guide to Implementing NAVRA,
please.
And it talks about targeted confirmation mailings, and that's what this is. It's creating a target. We're just dealing with the non-voters. It says, sending a forwardable confirmation notice provided for in Section 8, Sub D, Sub 2, based on the assumption that a failure to vote over an extended period of time may indicate that the registrant no longer lives at the jurisdiction. So the extended period of time is something you defined, mm-hmm. not, you know, not the federal statute. I think some of the factors in that is there are a lot of people that only vote in the presidential election. That's once every 4 years. And so you wanted to pick a time after that so that you're not picking those people up and sending them notices either. And so I think that's why the five-year period was selected over a shorter period.
Was there any other, if I can, any other reason to advocate five?
Not that I recall. Perhaps Scott or someone else might have a sharper recall than I have.
Test this out for me, would you? And my thought was that sending the notice to these individuals to make sure they're still living within mm-hmm. the district, indeed still living.
Mm-hmm.
You could have maybe a card that would go out that would allow you to check one of two boxes. One, the information on this card is correct, and I still want to be maintained on the active list. Or box number two, which would I get, or maybe there's three boxes. Box number two, the information on this card that was forwarded to me at this new address needs to be updated. Here's my new address within the jurisdiction. or my new name, my new gender, whatever it is, that you need to know. Or third...
I am dead. That'll clear that one up.
Or third, I do not wish to maintain status as an active voter. Drop me from the roll. And therefore, it's kind of up to the voter who is still doing everything that they needed to do to be registered. They could still register if they wanted to. That the emphasis is on retention as opposed to removal. And it just seems to me that once you sign up, unless you do something that disqualifies you, you ought to still be signed up. Because I think the practical part of this, and I guess as we discovered, is that, you know, some people thought they were participating by signing petitions. They may have contributed to campaigns. Perhaps they weren't motivated to go vote on the issue or for a candidate, but they still thought they were actively participating and probably still would like to have that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I regret I didn't bring a card to show you, because much of what you describe is a part of that notice, and it's defined by administrative rule and the statute. It has prepaid postage on it. It's business reply mail. They can either just check out everything's fine, everything cool, I'm still here, or complete a whole, you know, update the registration. If I send them a card and they get it because it's forwardable and they're in Bend, they can fill that card out, give it to Bend, and they're updated and rolling. But in the meantime, I've inactivated them, and they're in my inactive file until I get that notice from Ben saying, oh, we got them registered over here now. Then I can cancel them or remove them. So that's kind of the process. So we don't have that third checkbox saying, remove me. I'm still here. I just don't want to be registered. We don't have that third checkbox. But if they don't respond after missing two general elections, that's what would happen to them. They're still in inactive status. They can come in election day and activate themselves if they choose to vote and participate right up till after that second general that they missed.
So you can vote on election day
to oh, yeah.
this registration cutoff because
you're
on but just not active.
That's right. And again, the federal act requires that type of activity.
And help me through the initiative thing. What's the deal on that? Sign petitions.
No, because you're not an active. You need now activate.
Maybe we need to redefine that and say that people who are inactive and still on the roster can participate that way.
One, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller. One of the things that that this program, as outlined by the FEC guide, talks about is that these inactive voters are not in the numbers that you use for determining precincts, number of signatures for petitions. It talks about a number of administrative things, and I cite it in my letter to you in my comments that these are not a part of those numbers in this inactive status.
Charles, your words are need not include voters. That to me is a different meaning that will not, or just not understanding. But
okay, which paragraph are we?
You're up there on the second page, up there toward the top, underneath your bullets.
Okay.
House report noted it states
yeah,
need not
include voters in inactive status. Well, I'd have to go back and see if that was my supplied word or if that's how it was written.
Does that give us a little latitude to do what Senator Miller is suggesting? Is that the issue?
I think
can you tell?
Mr. Chair, I think that the House report even talked about other ways of activating voters. I think the House report is clear that while you're in inactive status, you're not a part of the administrative processes of the state. But how you activate, I think it left that up to the state.
What's the problem you're trying to fix? Initiative petitions or something else or everything?
I'm trying to allow as many people to participate in whatever way they
remain
be fit to do so.
Remain
fact,
active.
I'd ask, and maybe there's another way to do this, is for terms of mean, where this came about was the double majority and trying to determine how big the rolls are. Like, at least that was certainly good a lot of parties. And truly, those people who are not living probably shouldn't be continued. But the question is whether or not we should discontinue those who simply chose to sit out a couple of election cycles from constituting the majority required in that election. The other thing I'd ask you, just as a general proposition, and just get Senator Brown here, and she'll react, I know.
How many could be?
Is it appropriate to allow or to require someone to register to vote in order to sign a petition? Could you argue it's in the nature of some kind of free speech, and you shouldn't necessarily have to require or register to vote in order to participate in speaking your mind?
Mr. Chair, that's...
I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah, hang on a second.
Maybe not even thinking. I'm just talking.
And the problem you're trying to fix, Charles, with 2583 is...
The problem, Mr. Chair, that we were attempting to address is the voter that chooses not to vote but still wants to stay active. This would allow us not to include anybody that updates or anything like that. Any kind of activity would then drop them out of that cycle of the targeted mailing for confirmation.
Right.
See, so once they respond, then they got another whole... You know, they're good for 5 years.
5 years, okay.
And so what we were trying to do is narrow, as Senator Miller was attempting to narrow the targeted mailing. We're narrowing it down so that we would include not just those who hadn't voted in 5 years, but also those people who would be removed from that target, those who had responded in any way during that 5-year period.
Okay, Senator Byron and Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Charlie, does that, if a person has gotten that first notice, they're inactive, waiting that second general election, and they sign an initiative petition, I guess, does that then move them to the active status, or could it move them to the active status? Should we change the law to allow that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, under current law, the answer is no, it doesn't move him. Could it? You guys write the laws.
I mean, it seems like that would get at the point that Senator Miller was trying to get at, to preclude, not to preclude people from being able to sign petitions.
I think, if I may, Mr. Chair, one of the questions that would raise is, we may update them, put them back active based on the fact they signed, but are we updating them at what? You know, based on what, have they moved? Has there been change of information? Do we use the information provided on the petition form? Because under current law, that they could use an address on the petition form that they're not registered at. And as long as those things are within the district, we accept that, as long as we determine that they are the people signing it. Do we now use that to update address changes? I mean, you've got some other issues that tie into that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown.
I was sort of jumping up and down. Oh. Just in general. In terms of your question, I'm just being antsy.
She was honored today.
Question,
she's still kind of
honored today. It's still high. Yeah.
In terms of your question about not requiring people to be registered voters, my question to you would be, how would we delineate non-Oregonian and Oregonian residents?
Let's kind of stick to the bill here.
You could require on the petition, they supply their driver's license or some other identification.
Oh, no.
And then how would the Secretary of State verify that? That would be a problem.
He could check the DMV computer.
Which everyone has access to.
Which works flawlessly. Can I ask, is it necessary to have all these different categories of registrants? Can't you just be either registered or not registered?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, the federal law requires us to track those people who because of several information. They could be inactive from information we receive from a postal mailing saying these people have now moved to Kansas. Mm-hmm. We move those to inactive status under both state and federal law until that period of time lapses after the second general. So the law, the federal law anticipated and the state law anticipated that we're going to have to, we have a group of citizens who, are, while registered, aren't wholly registered, if I may use that term, and because there's still some elements missing. We have information that is not directly from them, third party, comes from the post office, from other sources, that would indicate these they moved or something else has happened. And the federal law anticipated that third-party information may not be as accurate as first-party, so therefore you will carry them through two general elections, allowing them to update that information should it be in error. And so that's why you have this category of inactive voters, and the federal law even talks about, or not the law, but the FEC guide to implementing it talks about inactive voters being monitored for a period, and they can, you know, so that you know whether or not you're going to purge them or not. The issue of whether or not canceled or purged, I threw those two in there because sometimes they get used interchangeably, and I thought it was important that we understand the terminology.
You want to take this thing with the charge a bit and see what the what's coming up with?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Let's make sure that both of you are speaking. You know, we reach a common agreement on what we need to be saying. So
okay.
We'll just close the hearing on this. Maybe ask you two to anybody else that is curious, kind of kick this out a little bit and see what we do. But we'll work off of 2583 as the vehicle, since that'll be the quickest and smoothest okay. thing. Okay, Fred, head nod.
Chairman.
Okay.
We state an objective for the. What the objective is to do?
I think the objective is to, you know, get a much clearer definition of what inactive really means.
Or I guess to go to Senator Miller's question,
yeah,
to try to provide
more. The committee feels about my desire is to be more inclusive. Is that?
That's a Democrat standard, so we've got
and Mr. Chair, that's what our bill is doing, is it being more inclusive also.
So the inclusivity aspect is where we're liking
to
head.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I do tend to follow that line of thinking. In fact, I'm kind of intrigued by the constitutional free speech question. I think it's an intriguing one, whether or not you actually have to be, if you're a person living within a state, whether you can constrain someone's speech. But I do think the courts recognize some limitation or at least ability to govern or decide whether they are a resident or not. How you do that, I don't know, but it raises some interesting questions. It really does.
Thank you.
Well, good. Very good. With that, eliminating discussion, we'll close the public hearing on 2583 and look forward to the dialogue.
I have a full report for you in short order, Mr. Chairman.
I'm excited. All right. Here's what we've been waiting for. All sessions, Senate Bill 551, the buyer extravaganza.
Hey.
Would you like to lead us through this, Senator Beyer?
Oh, good.
For our viewing audience, this is going to be the most exciting thing we've done all session.
Nebraska.
When is this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Lee Beyer, State Senator from Lane County, and I think this is the fourth time that I've introduced this bill, fourth session, although I think I was a co-sponsor in the 95 sessions with then Representative Brian Johnson. Who is here today also to talk?
Oh.
And I actually have brought you two versions of it for the brave at heart and for those who want to take the chicken's way out. One is SJR 20, which is a referral to the voters to see if they like the idea of nonpartisan. And the other one, Senate Bill 551, simply adds legislators, representatives, and senators, the offices thereof, to the list of nonpartisan positions in the state, which, if you look at that bill, line 18, it goes through and lists about 12 offices that are already nonpartisan in the state. So it's not, even here, in fact, I believe in 95 we added the position of Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries to that list, along with Superintendent of Public Instruction and many others. In seriousness, Mr. Chair, I kind of come to this position from my start in government in Oregon was at the local level, and my familiarity was with county courts, county commissions, and city councils, and many other bodies, which are all nonpartisan. And my experience has been that you had a broad range of people serving in those, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and in Eugene, even some Greens. But the matter is that it really had no effect on the business at hand. You're deciding issues. Certainly my experience in the legislature, I spent a couple of sessions in the House as the second-ranking member of the Democratic minority at that time, and certainly had a lot of experience with partisanship. And I've come to believe that the process works a lot better and can work a lot better without that. Oregon obviously is not alone in terms of having party influence, although you'll note that neither the Oregon Constitution, or for that matter the U.S. Constitution, is the mention of parties found anywhere. The constitutional framework doesn't define a partisan structure at all. It defines a method for members of the citizenry to be elected to the offices. And in fact, if you'll recall from your civic lessons, the United States government started out as a nonpartisan Congress. Of course, that only lasted for 8 years, and they moved into a party structure. In all seriousness, there are a couple of states that have had experience with legislatures that were nonpartisan. One of those still is nonpartisan and is the only unique legislature in the country, and that's Nebraska, that has a unicameral or one-house system and is nonpartisan. They got there, and I believe it was 1937, by the desires of a United States senator from that state who decided that partisanship was ruining the state. And he, on his own initiative, launched an initiative, and actually he launched two initiatives. One was to create a unicameral, move from a two-house system to a single-house system, and second was to make the office of state legislator nonpartisan. That passed overwhelmingly in that state. The other example was the state of Minnesota, which had for most of its history was a nonpartisan legislature and remained so up until after the Watergate era, when many of the Republicans were thrown out, and the Democrats chose to put it back into a partisan status. They made a mistake. Governor Ventura has been trying to turn that around since he was elected, although unsuccessfully to date, and in that status. I suppose that has to do with their now having their houses split among three parties, the Independents, Democrats, and Republicans. So that's really, I mean, it's really a very simple concept. The advantages, again, are you get down to dealing with the real issues, and you get out of what I consider to be the baseball game of choosing upsides with people playing the game. And I think if we're true with our, our knowledge of what we do in this place, it's you under a partisan system, you have to pretty much play the game with your side on most issues, and you rarely can cross the line because that's the way the game's played. You're not as free to vote independently or to deal with issues just as issues come. That's the reality, and we all know where the press room is and how to play that game. The other issue and primary advantage, one of the advantages, is cost. Quite frankly, we have four caucus offices in this building, all that are staffed very well, all great people who do a great job, but their only mission in life is to make sure their team is reelected the next time around. And that's the advice that they give each of us, and that's the way they view the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what partisan politics is all about. But it costs the people of Oregon about $6 to $8 million a biennium to play that game. So that's an issue. If you really look, if you like to read the history of this state, if you look back prior to actually the 1970s is when the change, almost the entire history of the state was a one-party state, and you had some of the same squabbles in the building. It was a Republican state. It was an original creation. It was a Democratic state, but then there was this little thing called the Civil War, and it changed right after that and was Republican for about 80 years. And during that period of time, you had controls. In fact, one of my mentors, who happens to be a Republican, those who know Stubb Stewart, a lumber baron in the area, when I was first appointed to the legislature, pulled me aside for dinner and he said, "Now, Lee, you don't have to be a partisan Democrat." We weren't when I was there in the 50s. He says, in fact, he says, when I was there, the Republicans controlled the House, and the first thing we did after electing a Republican speaker was to elect a Democrat as the chair of Ways and Means and a Democrat to run the powerful Rules Committee. Rules Committee, Mr. Chair. So there is a different tradition in this state, and the tradition, being nonpartisan, does not keep you from having splits. Necessarily, you're still going to have the honest discussions of differences between rural areas and urban areas. That's what this place is all about. You're still going to have differences of opinion on particular topics. When I've talked to two presiding officers of the Nebraska legislature over the years. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. Interestingly, the Republican was elected by a majority of Democrats. And that is the speaker. They call him Speaker of the Assembly or Speaker of the Senate. They call them senators there. And in each case, the second one is a Democrat. They said that it truly is a nonpartisan state. That doesn't mean that they don't have differences of opinion. But they said in terms of caucuses, they didn't have party caucuses, but they had occasional rural caucuses or urban caucuses, sort of like we have the Coastal Caucus or the Eastern Oregon Caucus. And they occasionally had roving issue caucuses, so you still have those. But I think that's legitimate issues. And the bottom line is it can work if people want it to, and it's been demonstrated to work in a number of different places, two legislatures and other things. So that's it. Other people who I thought would be interesting for you to hear from today that are here, at least three that I know of. Brian Johnson, who did a lot of research on this issue when he was in the House and spoke with the Nebraskans a lot. I knew you'd want to hear from him. And one that I find very fascinating, I handed out an article from 1999, Harry Baldine, who was a reporter for the Oregonian that covered this building from the mid-60s to the late 70s. And I followed him as a college student, was impressed with his byline a lot. And I found it fascinating with his article and his perspective. And I've asked that he come and share that with you, since he took the time to go back and spend a few weeks there to see if it was real or not. And I also think that Deidre Mullender from the, probably representing herself, not the Oregon Business Council, had her thoughts that she wanted to share with you also, I believe. I did have the opportunity last fall at the request of the Oregon Business Council to come up and talk to them about this concept. They had some interest in it, although I think when it got down to it, there were some other things that they decided were more important to their interest. But I'll tell you that there's a lot of interest by many people, including some of the senior CEOs in the state, about it. Mm-hmm. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm done.
You know how many people would be out of work if you did this?
There's a lot of work out there. You know, Intel is just searching for good people.
Anybody? Senator Beyer, questions?
Okay. This probably, Mr. Chair, falls into the comment that one of all of our good friends, Representative Markham, commented very quietly so he could hear it in the back of the room down in room 50 in 1997 when Representative Johnson first brought this in. As he leans over to Senator Corcoran and says, "Shall we shoot this dog in front of him or wait until he leaves the room?" Perhaps the dog will have legs.
There's some pretty obvious advantages. What are some of the downsides that leap out at you?
Well, probably one of the advantages of a two-party system is you do tend to take issues, and the nature of the baseball game forces you to look at both sides because you force the extremes. So I think there's that. That's probably the biggest downside, is that I've heard it said, in fact, I think the comment by one of the presiding officers from Nebraska, and I believe it was in a tape that Representative Johnson had, the question was made is, what's bad about that? And that was more towards the unicameral system, which the comment was, the good thing about that system is you can move bills very efficiently and very quickly. The downside is that's true of both good and bad bills.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to recall, George Will wrote an editorial in Newsweek about 2 weeks ago and talked about this whole issue. He didn't really talk about it in context of partisan politics, but he does address and refer to the Federalist Papers and some of the writings there with respect to certain factions and groups that form for the purpose of achieving some end result in terms of the politics and the dynamics of politics, which I guess I would equate to the, you know, effectively what major political parties attempt to do now. But you also have minority parties who also struggle to get their issues heard and to achieve, like we heard the other day, major political party status and to move their ideas to the forefront. And it's really that struggle and dynamic between those factions of individuals that really creates a catalyst for discussion and ideas. So I guess I wonder if we were all part of a nonpartisan group, do we become the majority that in essence overruns or rules, you know, becomes, I guess, a tyranny to the minority? Do we just simply all think that somehow we all are going to get along and therefore, you know, we're getting along for the sake of getting along as opposed to really arguing about points that are brought to us by people who disagree with us vehemently?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnesota, I think you need to address that question to Mr. Voldeen when he's up here, who actually observed what it was like in Nebraska. My own observation is that at least on the city councils that I've served on and the local governments I've worked with, there didn't seem to be a lack of diversity of ideas. that wasn't prevalent. I don't think that necessarily has to happen. I don't think you need to have I guess I would answer that in a state as diverse as Oregon, what drives differences of opinion is what causes us to be here and why we have separate districts is someone who, Senator Harper, who represents a rural community on the south end of the state is going to have a very different opinion on many issues or perspective as someone who represents the largest city, such as you do. The nice thing about the legislative process is what I find myself saying a lot over the years as I sit down and you start looking at a bill and you come in and you say, that's kind of what I'm thinking. And then someone will sit in this chair and start throwing ideas out and you think, oh, you know, I never thought of that. And it's because it's not in your frame of reference. I think that's what's distinctive and important about the legislative process, not which team you're on, whether you're wearing the blue jerseys or the red jerseys. And that doesn't really make a difference. Ideas are ideas and the process, what's important here is the debate of ideas and the exchange and coming together through compromise and the policies that will make a better place to live in Oregon.
Jason, do you have anything?
Not, yes, Mr. Chairman. I think this is just fascinating. And
that may be three, Mr. Chair.
That's it.
A couple of
87-3 if you want on board.
Just a couple of fascinating, to me, historical points as you were talking about the Constitution. When George Washington was president for the first two terms, essentially the second United States presidency, which most people don't know, there was the Continental Congress. There was actually five people who took the office of president.
President of the Congress, though.
Right. But the first one, I forget his name, resigned because he didn't think the job had any future. But I find it fascinating, you know, if you talk about the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, in the third presidential election, the first time we got the negative campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The debate between Hamilton and Jefferson was the birth, one could argue, is the birth of negative campaigning and the beginning, essentially, of partisan politics when the two sides went away. And the next interesting point was, since those two parties went and they did essentially what became the Whigs and the Democrats, there was a third little party that snuck up that got very involved. And I'm reading about this now, I'm not an expert, but the committee will find this interesting. What would push the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, and it was this group of people, and I don't think they became official party status, but perhaps we could, many people would brand us as the same name if we move this bill forward. The name of this movement was called the Know-Nothings. Are you a Know-Nothing? Oh, yes, I'm a Know-Nothing. And it was this code word for moving that presidency. Anyway, lots of things.
And I think that party then later took the formal name of the Republican Party.
Hey.
Actually, I had on my notes here just the opposite.
Move it to table.
Senator Breyer, I guess just want your thoughts. When we don't know, when we as individual members don't know how we're going to vote on a piece of legislation, my guess is we look to our caucus colleagues, and if that fails, our party colleagues, party folks. Do you, is it your sense that folks would consider the individual merits of each piece of legislation differently, more open-mindedly, more thoroughly than we do now, given our ability to rely on our caucus colleagues or party ideology or whatever?
Well, I would hope, Senator, that we do that now. But I think the reality is that at least it's been my experience that you tend to develop relationships around topic areas with different legislators that you trust their opinion in that area, and you go to them. At least I find myself not always going just within the caucus. In fact, there are a number of people in our caucus that I agree with on some issues and pretty strongly disagree with on others. And I frankly find that true of the folks from the other side of the aisle also. But I think that's the nature of the business, and you trust committees.
But I think you would, Kate, you'd get yourself into issues rather than people that believe in those issues rather than parties. Mm-hmm. To me, it would clean up an awful lot of stuff. But let's have some further testimony. Let's get maybe if all three of you, Harry, Deidre, and Brian, could come up, we'd appreciate it. And, it's fascinating, but not going anywhere, but fascinating.
Why not?
Well, Miller, he left us when we brought the bill up. Yeah.
I haven't had a work group already.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
The rose.
Good afternoon. My name is Deirdre Molander. I live in Portland, and I work for the Oregon Business Council, as Senator Breyer said. This afternoon, I'm here to testify on my own personal belief, and my comments don't reflect the official position of the Oregon Business Council. I come before you today to speak in support of a nonpartisan state legislature, and I suggest three fundamental reasons why you should consider this. First, I think that a nonpartisan legislative election would encourage voters to select candidates based on their positions on the issue rather than their particular party affiliation. Under the current system, in order to be a viable candidate, most people select a political party even though they may not agree with all of the positions on that party's political agenda. A nonpartisan election would encourage voters to truly understand the positions of the candidates, and I think it would give the candidates even more incentive to make sure that the voters clearly understood what their positions were on the issue. The second reason to support this legislation is that in a nonpartisan legislature, senators and representatives, I believe, would consider legislation based on its merits, regardless of which political party supports the legislation, and I know in most cases you do that now, and this speaks a bit to the question that Senator Brown asked earlier. And I do appreciate that there are many examples of bipartisan support for legislation. However, under the current system, the party that's in the majority has significantly more influence over the legislative agenda. And I think that a nonpartisan legislature would reduce the influence of the political party agenda on a particular piece of legislation and increase the influence of individual legislators' positions on the particular piece of legislation. The third reason to support this legislation is that a nonpartisan legislature would facilitate the election of legislative leadership that both represents and is accountable to the entire legislative body, not just one political party. Under the current system, the political party in the majority has significant control over who becomes Senate President, Speaker of the House, and who has positions as committee chairs. I believe in a nonpartisan legislature. The legislative leadership and the committee chairs would be selected because of their skills, their experience, and their position on the issues, not just their political party affiliation. In closing, I'd like to say that a nonpartisan legislature, I believe, would mean a focus on issues that are important to Oregon, not issues that are important to a political party. City and county elections are nonpartisan, and I think that legislative races should be as well. I thank you for your time this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodine, if I may, Mr. Bodine is listed as neutral, so maybe another advocate should go first, and then you could hear from the neutral. Thank you, Mr. Bodine. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Johnston. I reside in Salem, and as Deirdre, I too am an advocate for the bill. I approached, as Senator Byer said a moment ago, this hearing with some trepidation because I wore the last one as a stain on my legislative accomplishments during the 95 session. But with that out of the way, I think the question that the bill addresses is a very simple one. Is the process that we have the most effective way to use the citizens and the election process in Oregon? And I think the answer is no, and a nonpartisan legislature would be, I think, a better way to accomplish it. I think it's a function of organization. The political process, the political parties play two functions. They substitute as information for an electorate that may not be fully informed on the issues, and they allow for organizational techniques inside the legislative body itself, and that is, namely, the first vote determines the Speaker or the President, and the Speaker or the President establishes the rest of the offices. I think that's a function of size. I speak to you today as a Democrat. I intend to stay registered as a Democrat and would stay registered as a Democrat even if we moved for a nonpartisan legislature and I made a decision to re-enter this political fray. I would be a Democrat but would run for election from my district. I think all the people up on that podium have known of at least one candidate who they thought was an absolute super candidate but lived in the wrong district. Now, how can that be? Well, it's simply a matter of party registration. If you're a wonderful candidate but live in Portland and your registration in some neighborhoods in Portland and your registration is Republican, the chances of you winning the Oregon lottery are significantly better than winning the election. If conversely you're a Democrat and live in some districts in this state and your chances are, et cetera, you understand where I'm going with that. And we've known wonderful candidates, people who we think have the right wherewithal to be intellectually productive in this body, but lack the party registration that would make them appropriate for their district. Similarly, once people get here, the functioning inside this body is, as Senator Byer suggested, oftentimes a function of party as opposed to issue. Now, not always. We all know that the vast majority of bills are based entirely on their merits and, in fact, are relatively uniform. Most things pass both chambers by a sizable margin if they pass. It is that small number of bills that is philosophic that can become the subject matter of party loyalty as opposed to rigorous debate and scrutiny. The Congress of the United States, that, I think, is too large a body to be a nonpartisan body, 435 people, too difficult to organize. The Oregon legislature, 90 people, is not difficult to organize. The amount of information available to the electorate is adequate for them to judge on the issues, is this man or woman a good fit for this district, not on the party registration question. And that's really where we are. What's the most efficient way for Oregon to get the most out of the men and women who serve them in this body and have the most productive elections? And I would agree with the good senator who introduced this bill that the most efficient way for Oregon is to be a nonpartisan legislature. I would say, finally, that I have available, if anyone would like it, the interview I conducted several years ago with Senator Whitman, and who was at that time the presiding officer of the Nebraska legislature, and the county and the clerk for that body. In it, as the senator suggested, they made one admonition, and that is that the unicameral system is not necessarily the friend of deliberative government, that once an idea gets momentum, it is too difficult to stop
as the good senator suggested a moment ago, the parties, people coalesce around it. That's why I hope the senator's bill, and I know the earlier versions of it, maintains the two-chamber piece, because it allows for the give and take necessary between equals so that things can be slowed down and things can be scrutinized appropriately. I would urge your leadership in this effort.
Thank you, Brian. Harry?
Excuse me, Harry Bodine. I would just caution anyone who talks about deliberative process to think about the Oregon Senate and the House of Representatives in the last 72 hours of this legislative session and the last one, when things can happen very fast. It used to be a joke. I covered the Oregon legislature for the Oregonian from 1967 to 75, and the Senate was, you know, had two speeds of operating. One was glacial, and the other was supersonic. And I've witnessed both, and I'm sure that you folks have too. I would like to, I'd almost like to change my neutral to a yes on this, just to try it to see what it would be like. But I became an advocate, a fan, I guess, really, of the Nebraska unicameral system way back in 1967, when I sat on the floor of the Oregon House the last day of a special session and watched the House kill everything the Senate had voted on for the last 5 weeks. And across the rotunda, the Senate was returning the favor. So 0 times 0 equals 0. And I thought, this is sort of a strange way to make law. I retired from the paper 3 years ago, and I've made two trips to Nebraska. And the last one, I actually spent the last month of the session. And believe me, it is nothing like this operation. As far as deliberation and debate goes, I have seen debate go to almost picayune levels on legislation. Of course, you can also see it here. But for on and on and on. I gave you a little handout, and on the back side of it, there's a little piece there about how a bill becomes law. And I think you should realize that before a bill does become law in Nebraska, that it has to go... It runs the hurdle three times. It has to be passed by the full legislature on three separate occasions before it becomes law and goes to the governor for his signature or veto. The process, frankly, one way they solved this problem, and incidentally, there were about 900 bills introduced in the legislature in Lincoln 2 years ago, but one way that they focus is that midway through the session, each member of the legislature identifies a priority bill. Each committee identifies two priority bills. The speaker identifies about a dozen, but that also includes what the governor wants. These pieces of legislation automatically go to the head of the line in consideration. That's how they focus on what's important. And once again, every member, because there's the youngest freshman has the same ability to have a mark. I thought about Ryan Deckert when he was down here as a freshman Democrat from Washington County, and did he get this kind of treatment? I don't think so. And frankly,
treated him wonderfully.
I'm sure you did. And I think that those of
shocked that you would think otherwise.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
his ideas were dumb.
I just also would remind you that this body went 40 years without a Republican Senate president. And I can remember some times back in the Vicatea, Tony Meeker days, when the crowd of seven Republican senators, it was lonely. I mean, not much was going on. Anyway, just if I may make a few extra points, the elections are nonpartisan. I can tell you that the system is that candidates file just like you do for the school board. The two candidates who receive the most votes in the primary election both advance to the general election for a runoff. You register by party in Nebraska just like you do in Oregon, and the current legislature, I'm sorry, the 99 session, had 27 registered Republicans, 22 registered Democrats, and 2 independents. The Republicans elected, the legislature elected a Republican as Speaker, but elected Democrats as Chairman of the Revenue Committee, the Education Committee, and about two or three other committees of the group. The power is really diffused. The entire legislature elects the officers by secret ballot, and they also elect all the committee chairmen in alphabetical order, agriculture, appropriations, all the way through to urban affairs. The entire body votes on who wants to, on the candidates for chairman.
secret ballot for this?
It's a secret ballot, and the reason for the secret ballot, and I was very disturbed by the secret ballot, but there's a reason for it, and that is it enables a Republican to vote for a Democrat as chairman without getting hassled by the political party. The only time that really that partisanship really raises its head in Lincoln is when a bill comes up on which the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have different views. Then you'll see the party lines coalesce, but that's the only time that that really happens, I was told, and when I was there, I saw no evidence of it otherwise. Just beyond that, just a second here. And a committee assigns bills to the standing committees for, decides which committee will hear which bill. Not one individual. A committee does that. As I mentioned, to become law, the bill has to run the gauntlet three times, and the priority bills are there. The other thing, with two houses, and Senator Beyer, will we still have the situation which I've observed in this building, where one house will hold a bill hostage to get consideration of another bill. When you're all sitting in one room, and there are 49 of them in this case, that game doesn't work. And also, I'll just mention that every moment that legislature is in session, you can watch it on Channel 16 on cable. Not real exciting, but it's there. The other thing, Senator Beyer mentioned George Norris, who played a key role in getting the people of Nebraska talked into this in the 1934 general election. And what Norris was really trying to get away from, as much as anything else, was conference committees. The House passes one version, the Senate another, and then typically, and he was, of course, his experience was Congress, everybody goes behind a closed door, people chosen by the leadership, and they write the bill. It comes back, and it's, I presume, the same way here. When it gets back to the House and Senate, it's yes or no. You know, it's no changes beyond that point. The other thing is that it's been my experience that there is a last-minute jam-up in this legislature. A lot happens the last week of the session. In Lincoln, it's not that way. It's much more orderly. The only bills that I saw being held hostage in 1999 were some the governor wanted. And they wanted to make the legislative leadership wanted to make sure that the governor didn't hurl any last-minute vetoes, which would screw up the works. The governor did veto a bill early in the session, one dealing with education appropriations. This was on a Friday. On Monday, the legislature came back and voted 43-3 to override. There was no party loyalty there at all. Parliament spoke, and it really kind of cleared the air, and after that, things went much smoother. And the last day of the session, Governor Johannes, who was a freshman, came in and basically gave a little talk to the legislature and said everybody did a great job, and, you know, three cheers for our side, and we're on our way. It's a consensus-driven operation. Senator Brown's question about, you know, talking to people in the caucus. I think what I saw there was that obviously certain senators were closer to others, and they have a tendency to go to the people they trust. And one bill I saw, there was a little problem on it because the senator testified on the floor, was speaking on behalf of the bill, and got a little mixed up on the facts, and that didn't get clarified, and there was a suddenly there's a credibility problem that was right there in that chamber. But you know, you're going to find that any place, I think. I would certainly invite questions about it. And just one last one on the cost. When I checked a year ago, the legislature had appropriated, I think, $57 million to run this operation for a two-year period. The same appropriation in Lincoln was for about $26 million. Your deal here is twice as expensive as theirs. And if my math's right, if you took that out 10 years, you're talking a third of $1 billion.
And they have 49. Like
49 members. Yeah, the constitutional limit of 50. And frankly, if I were writing a constitutional amendment for Oregon, I would go for 45. Because I think if you get too large, Senator Johnson referred to this, you know, that the House representatives of the U.S. or New Hampshire with 400 members, I can't imagine how this thing would work. But anyway, if you have questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Senator Brown.
I just wanted to recognize I had served with Representative Johnson, and I had seen his children last, I think, in 1995 when we went rollerblading. So I just wanted to say welcome to, I assume, Courtney and Drew Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, thank you very much. That is my son, Drew Johnston, in the back, but the young lady is my niece, Molly Johnston, who's visiting from Denver, Colorado.
Okay. I thought she'd changed a lot. But your son is definitely your son.
Well, there are some curses we all have to bear.
But in Nebraska, there are still Democrats and Republicans.
There are. The statewide offices are elected on a partisan basis.
Statewide is partisan.
Statewide, and also they have, they elect in congressional delegation. Congressional delegation, of course, but other offices like, the, for example, the Board of Regents of the University of Nebraska is elected on a nonpartisan basis. And there are several others. They have a strange constitution, and I certainly would not advocate picking up much of it.
Senator Miller, is that the...
I noticed in the article, Mr. Chairman, that there... state budget is $2.4 billion.
That's the general appropriation bill. That's the general government appropriation bill. It's the Big Bertha.
Which, I wish that was our Big Bertha at that level.
It was 15 years ago.
We'd be out of here in a lot less time, too. The other thing I noticed, they got out one day less than the 90-day limit. The Constitution allows an odd number of days. They meet annually?
They do meet annually, 90 days in odd-numbered years, 60 and even. And those are legislative days, not calendar days. In fact, you folks might be interested. One of the nice things, features of the system, is in January when they organize, they set up the calendar for the next 5 months. My wife and I had a very nice, we had one four-day weekend while we were there, and two or three-day weekends, because frankly they feel that the legislators should have a chance to get back home, and so they just take off Thursday afternoon, and incidentally some of them have to drive farther than Ontario. We don't really try to realize it. So that and incidentally the latest I ever saw them go at night was 9 p.m. And that was about the week before the session was drawing to a close. The main appropriation bill goes through by the 80th day, and after that, it's just there's a lot of automatic pilot to this. It doesn't mean everything passes. Everything doesn't, obviously.
Well, you may have noticed that a bill that Senator Beyer and I authored and was helped out by this committee passed our Senate 24-4 recently that had fairly similar prescription, at least a 150-day limit over a 2-year period. And we think that, at least it's our belief, that if you have a set ending date, that maybe you manage the days you have a little better than perhaps has been our experience here.
And I guess my comment on that is I think the priority bill approach would be very helpful to get you to that goal line.
Mm-hmm. How do you think politically, there's only one of these states, and this is nonpartisan, there's only one of these states in the nation. So, I mean, it's an idea that hadn't really caught on.
How do you think politically you'd move something like this?
Mr. Chair, I think that if we were to commission a poll, we'd find that the nonpartisan concept has great resonance with the electorate. Parties are not held in the highest of respect, as you're probably aware.
I make it different with you. I just saw a poll today. We're up to the high single digits.
Well, that's about legislators.
Yeah. The trajectory may be fine. But the I think the difficulty, Mr. Chair, is that the this represents a significant a change for people conceptually, especially the concept of how does one organize, because it is very simple to say by voting Republican, if I went to a door, for example, Mr. Chair, in my District 31, which has a 9% Republican registration edge, and I knocked on the door of a man named Ted Shea, who some of you might know, who taught political science for years at Willamette, and I thought I would be warmly received, sharing many of the same backgrounds. He said, well, I can't possibly vote for you. And I said, why not? And he said, well, you're a Democrat. And I said, but Mr. Shea. And he said, oh, don't bump me anything. You're going to vote for some Democrat for Speaker.
And he was right. That was my intention. as it turned out, I should point out that's not the case. I voted for Bev Clarno for Speaker, as did everyone that year.
No?
Well, then she was a representative, and there was a unanimous vote on the first one. But at any rate, Mr. Chair, my point is that people understand how it is you organize. That's clear and it's out there, and those interests who are interested in government who can afford it support that organizing premise. This would throw that out. And for many people, it's too frightening a thought that it might be left up to the powers of persuasion and even the powers of logic to determine how one organizes.
You know, Brian, we think we're real smart sitting inside this building all day, every day, without even getting outside much. And I'd be curious to see what kind of polling numbers public interest there would be. Senator Minnis.
I've been in this body since 1985, April 18th, and came in by appointment.
Who's counting?
I have. Well, but I think the interesting thing that my experience here, I'm a member of a labor union, and I'm a Republican. I'm not a rich man. I work for a living, and I have run the gamut in this process, in terms of ideological issues and committee chairs and experience. I have had the audacity to disagree with my party and suffer the consequences of that. And the thing that I think I find interesting is the dynamic of speech, which gets back to the early concept that Senator Miller brought. The thing that I like about the affiliation of parties is it does draw us into teams, so to speak, to bring that argument together, because I don't believe that we live in a world where everybody's holding hands and trying to get along necessarily. The fact is we do disagree. And I think the form in which you develop that public discussion, whether it's Democrat, Republican, Independent, Green Party, Christian Democrat, whatever you want to call it, to me, that's the dynamic that we should be protecting. And I think it's a pipe dream and a fallacy to believe that somehow you create an environment that's a nonpartisan, and all of this goes away, and we all get along. I just don't think that's true. And what I was going to say is, if anybody should be bitter about being a Republican or a member of a party who's suffered the disciplines of being a party member who's had the audacity to speak out against leadership, I should be. But yet, I think the truth of all of that is the fact that dynamic of speech is the thing that we should covet in our Constitution, covet in the systems of government. And I just wonder about whether or not a nonpartisan concept does that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if I may, I think the comparison is incorrect. I don't think it's correct to compare the current two-party, basically two dominant viewpoints with a kumbaya-like atmosphere that would be caused by a nonpartisan legislature. I think quite the converse is true. Instead of two partisan viewpoints upon which one could coalesce, you would have more. The reality is that there are more ideas who could be brought to the table, and more ideas, more voices that could be heard in that arena. Consequently, rather than just the dominant voice and an echo, I think that you would have several or eight ideas competing in that marketplace.
But let me give you an argument in opposition. Mr. Bodine raised it, and that is that in the Nebraska legislature, the way they circumvent that discussion is they give each member a priority bill. Or each committee two priority bills. You still end up by some mechanism suppressing speech.
Mr. Chair,
there's a operation of the unicameral legislature as a single body, and I don't think that's a reference to the nonpartisan aspect.
I think that's an organizational principle that allows for an agenda setting technique. It doesn't.
Let me tie it in. I object to our Senate rules, for instance, that limit the number of bills legislators can introduce. Because I think what that does is it limits speech. I got elected to represent a group of people, 70-some thousand registered voters. One of those comes to me with an idea after the deadlines are passed, I'm pretty well limited, with the exception of I have to come and beg to the chair of this committee to get their idea introduced. I think...
Not nearly as loose as judiciary.
Yeah, you're a lot harder than I am, for sure. But you have the power because you are the chair of this committee. So anyway, I just wanted to state my opinion and just kind of...
Senator Minnis, if I might, I think a lot of the bills that, first of all, in Nebraska, there's an early cutoff on introduction of bills. I was amazed 2 years ago, at the 1st of April, we were introducing 100 bills a day in the House of Representatives the day I was there. It's amazing, that late in session. In Lincoln, they cut off the bill introductions earlier. And frankly, the time to get these other measures that you're interested in is pumping through the system earlier. And that's when a lot of it happens. The thing is, when you get down, it was mentioned, a procedural thing. Midway through the session, the clock is running. There's a time limit. So, okay, what are we going to work on? And that's how the priority bill gets done. The other thing I would say to you is that I did not detect any inkling that the nonpartisan legislature was a damper on ideas or on viewpoints. And especially when members have the ability to amend on the floor on the first two times the bill goes by. There's lots of stuff that's interesting.
Here's an interesting idea.
That was an idea that got shot earlier.
I know the history here has been that it happens in committee. I know that. Changes happen in committee.
Interesting. Well, you know, most things like this take about a decade to get done. You got another 6 years to go. Any other thing for the testimony? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Thank you, Lee, for bringing that up. And with that, we are in the public hearing, and we will adjourn. Do we have anything to do?
We just have Senator Courtney's redistricting, if anybody's interested in going.
Oh, tonight?
We have elections.
No bills.
No bills. No.
Okay.